Hello, and welcome to Royal Air Force Museum Research Lecture Series. This recording, from the 28th of February 2019, is of a lecture by Squadron Leader Lee Ashcroft, entitled Command Leadership in the Royal Air Force, an Exploration of Changing Leadership Challenges in Returning to Contingent Operations.
I wasn't very nervous until I saw my head of branch sitting over there, so I'll try and be, hope he's gentle with me later. Okay, that's me, Squadron Leader Ashcroft, and that's the title. What I'd like to emphasise is that if there's any questions, please fire them to me at the end. I'd like to encourage an open forum, and this subject is a think piece. Okay, whilst recent conflicts have demonstrated tactical excellence, military analysts such as Stringer and Ritchie have criticised the lack of scholarly input into this area of study. That does not fully explain how air power will succeed at the operation level. It has become more pronounced since campaigning in Optelic in 2003, where there's been a disruption from senior leaders on air-centric strategies adopted since the end of the Cold War. I believe the issue is one of command leadership or generalship, more specifically air power being used to its full exploitation at all levels of war. The corollary to this is that command ethos is somehow pushed down the line and not explored as an organisation. Historiography provides a rich narrative of successful air generals in the past, Trenchard, Dewey, Mitchell, to name a few. The narrative certainly reflects a big man theory and personalities and personalises the theorists by championing the warrior elite of the pilot culture. The cultural limitations post-Second World War suggest a lack of air generalship because there have been fewer people to inform and influence this success. Instead, it would appear the void is being partly filled by extensive leadership studies and doctrinal pamphlets without a firm grasp behind the nature of what it means. One of the key issues is that the middle management of the Air Forces, who can shape and influence the strategic thinking and opinion, has been limited to literature that does not fully codify or interpret command leadership. It offers scholars little insight into the cultural relationship with its airmen and how war is waged. The nature of warfare today needs to consider how command leadership has evolved in a new setting, particularly when and how to employ lethal force. I want to explore if this is the case, and what can be done to prepare the RAF for contingent operations? Clausewitz astutely discerned that war and its inherent complexity is inexorably changing. War is less distinct and slightly foreshortened than the traditional means of interstate warfare, blurring the compression lines between all three levels of war, strategic, operational, and tactical. Events in Syria and the intrastate conflict in Ukraine shows conflict has moved on from the AFPAC wars of the Obama administration. Limited war and counterinsurgency now dominate the political agenda, where there is an increasing requirement to balance overseas presence with power projection aspirations and meeting national military objectives. The fictional world you see in Singer's World War III novel Ghost Fleet is a prescient view in how decisive strategic effect with tactical level actions using striking power of technology to find and locate critical targets in the literal battle space is critical, as one example. There is a fundamental need to train and select our commanders to think for themselves in these future air and space environments and to command the airmen appropriately. There have been many attempts to interpret generalship or command leadership, understand the scope of the term, and develop a baseline past and present of what constitutes acceptable air generalship. The most compelling definition comes from Fuller, the last notable author to refer to generalship. He argued it is made up of the physical, intellectual, and moral, which can be synthesized into two generalizations, personal leadership and professional capacity. My best interpretation is the officer's trinity here. It represents the need for commanders to have vision, to deal with complex issues, conceptual and abstract thoughts, and the need to think about the tactical concerns of a unit commander. Only a few commanders will emerge who are outstanding in all three levels. The RAF recognizes leadership as an intellectual activity to strengthen service ethos, but has done very little in developing strategy above leadership style. Stringer confirmed this in 2014, arguing that air generals, those who lead the RAF in operations, had presented a unique set of demands of commanding air operations that required an improved education and training focus for those destined to lead. Without it, Stringer asserts, air generals would be destined to think like line managers rather than air power strategists. What training on operational design that does exist at Military Staff College plays a huge emphasis on campaign planning, perhaps criticises linear in process and divorced from the strategic realities of the situation. There is also no provision for a specific general's course in the RAF to promote this knowledge and prepare senior Air Force officers for their future general careers. Instead, this will be overcome from personal and professional experience. To get round the problem, Air Forces have promoted their pilots in the hope that by accident it will help prepare them for the highest air power appointments. So, in terms of defining those leadership, command leadership in the RAF can be summed up in three veins. Strategic leadership, providing grand strategic direction, Chief of the Air Staff. C2 at the operational and tactical level, Air Officer Commanding, or 1 to 2 star. Delivering grand strategic intent and the senior leadership teams. Fundamental to generalship is the C2, the command control, the kernel of their activity. And command is an act of will based on considerations outside the system it is commanding. Like a radiator, control is the ability to adjust, which means knowing what is actually happening and having some means of affecting it. Whilst both are separate entities, deciding what to do affects the act of command. In command, the aim for air commanders is to balance tactical, joint air, command and control in the joint operating area. Execution of such activities would be decentralized through air command and control systems. The challenge to this principle is how closely the joint force air component commander wishes to manage its strategic efficiency at the expense of flexible campaign planning. So that's the C2, that's this strategic control of a decentralized execution. Redefining how the RAF applies operational arts in its strategic thinking when the JFAC appointment could arrest this problem. This would involve the application of JFAC strategy into an operational design, integrating key activities at all levels of war. Like an artist creating a painting, the commander control confronts the challenge by developing a campaign that is easily understood. Concept and practice of command leadership is therefore at the heart of the matter. Scholars such as Mahoney suggest lack of generalship is attributable to low organisational confidence. The RAF as an organisation may not be helping. String and Ritchie assert that since the Cold War, the RAF has potentially eschewed the need to develop strategic theory, which stems from its cultural beginnings as an independent air force from Trenchard himself. Post-1917, a counterculture existed where the public school system, like the army, filtered down, permeating the organisation and encouraging maverick behaviour and hijinks. High confidence was seen through to the Second World War, but following the Cold War, it is suggested that organisational confidence has dipped during the more frequent jointery and conflicts post-1990s. Why is this? The issue seems to be Cold War itself, yet to apply lessons from the past, such as Kosovo in the 1990s. Even the Cunningham Keys project, post-Operation Telic, failed to resolve C2 issues in air power as it prepared the RAF for fighting existential threats following the Cold War. NATO and the Air Force had been designed to fight the Red Army as it swarmed over the plains of Europe. Everyone knew what to do in their single service bubble and what it needed to be done. There was a broad acceptance of single service capabilities and a high degree of organizational confidence. The Navy focused on deterrence with Trident, the RAF on strategic bombing and its air power roles, and the Army on land maneuver. The rigid nature of air power delivery during the Cold War was simple, but understood, despite question marks over its integration into a joint operational design. When the Warsaw Pact collapsed, NATO had to prepare for something else of which no one could specify. Traditional methods of C2 had to be replaced, and it was done with mission command and joint operations. Command today covers those aspects of leadership with setting and giving direction, predicated on delivering mission command. General Bagwell successfully introduced it into the army during the mid-80s in response to the flexible response strategies against the Soviets. He also introduced the High Command Staff College for its best and brightest officers across all three services. However, it would seem mission command has not fully addressed the intellectual chasm with current air power practice. Redressing the balance requires a review of air power critical thinking, and much more could be done in the RAF's relationship in gaining the conceptual edge over its sister services. RAF culture is not so different to its sister services as they recruit primarily from the same social levels. There is a clear continuity of leadership influencing ethics post-First World War. For example, RAF drill and ceremonial is based on straightforward leadership principles that are the same as the Army and Navy. Similarly, the projection of personality was deemed important to both services. It reflects underlying stereotypes that shape our character and ethos. Barnett suggested that spontaneous emergence of force derived from the basic willpower of personality. Admiral Fisher used it to great effect when introducing widespread social justice and efficiency into the Navy at the turn of the century. Similarly, Air Marshal Park and Dowding fashioned a powerful and formidable partnership to help win the Battle of Britain. But here is where the similarities end. Ross Mahoney believes the cause is cultural immersion, initial officer training, and that flows down from senior leadership. Mao saw Air Force pilots as glamorous elites, distorted as caricatures in films rather than real warriors, as we see in the character Lord Fashheart from the Blackadder Goes Forth series. Lawrence, in his CBS coverage of Vietnam, even saw them as a wild bunch that mixed mischief with egocentric behavior in leading men. By codifying its image around flying, the RAF developed a unique identity of its own that reflects this culture. Air Marshal Curtis once said that pilots are more equal than others, and the preference of pilots in senior command positions solidified post-Second World War. Therefore, a distinctive pilot culture has developed with a pervasive expectation of pilot elitism considered essential in maintaining ethos and fighting power. Unlike regimental loyalty in the Army, RAF pilots did not identify with the corporate values of the Air Force on station based around the squadron core values or a ship in the Navy. This conundrum has never been solved and does remain open to debate. What it has done, though, is influence the technocratic mind and thinking in the RAF we see today, as it draws on those well-educated specialist individuals from grammar schools that are broad-minded in outlook. The new RAF, with its increasing dependence on technology and the educated personnel, quickly found that a more relaxed way of working between officers and airmen was required instead of the rigid hierarchical system evident elsewhere. Furthermore, it could be argued that education and technical mindedness enabled RAF officers to think strategically around the global security environment, or I hope so. Both generalizations of pilot culture and relaxed command structures came about because of the perception that Air Force and Naval officers are more comfortable with concepts than definitions due to the importance of strategic culture. So Barnett attempts to understand the difference by explaining it in hypothetic constructs, strategic, operational, and tactical. In the Army, it is defined by distance at intercontinental, theatre, or the battlefield. For Air Force, strategic levels of warfare are expressed in the intensity of conflict. Therefore, strategic is nuclear, operational and tactical are often merged with progressively lesser levels of non-nuclear conflict, differentiated by scale. For Navy strategists, levels of warfare are defined by objectives, where distance was of no object. Whether inspired by Jomini, Hart, Clausewitz, or Machiavelli, strategic thinking has dominated the doctrine and military pamphlets of the Air Force, thereby influencing how our commanders think. To many, the connection between the two is not obvious, but an important one to understand the psyche of air generalship or our command leadership. Strachan, on the other hand, refuted the requirement for strategic culture in the military and believed that to understand current practice, command leaders need to understand strategic theory. He saw command leadership in a power projection narrative played out in the real politic of the international order. The independent-minded nature of the Air Force spirit was dominated by the offensive spirit without thought to its culture and its spectrum of use. Essential to this concept is the role of purpose, which Friedman saw as being largely unrecognized in most theories of power today. Instead, what we see today is a lot of autobiographical accounts from former generals such as Jackson Richards, which has perhaps skewed our interpretation of air power application through the lens of Herrick-based experiences. It means that the purpose would feature heavily on the battlefield, but potentially not in the way the Air Force wants it to be seen, that is the case. Strategic culture, on the other hand, is the production of intended effects, whereas leadership lies in the dimensions of intent. The psychological dimension of culture only serves to provide a basis of understanding in the relationship of power to leadership. Strachan argues strategic culture was embedded within the post-Second World War cultural legacy of a divided Germany, which caused the emerging security dilemma to conflate the perspective of command leadership. Unfortunately, the historian's narrow focus on the historical use of strategic bombing, for example, and its development has misdirected the utility and doctrinal commitment to working with other services. The AP 1300, although I acknowledge is outdated, for example, looked at integrated bombing rather than strategic bombing, in which it highlighted that air power could deliver a potent weapon in an offensive role as part of a joint force working together. Therefore, the challenge of this paper has been to link the past with the present and to provide a tangible understanding to the nature of strategic culture and strategy that informs the analysis. Part of the problem is the way theorists such as Lilhart have interpreted strategy in the past and neglects the role of our Air Force leadership in effect and intent, I alluded to earlier. He argued that direct attacks involving air power would never work on an opponent. Instead, he advocated a more land-based indirect approach of surprise and decisive effort. This does not help the historian codifying or making generalizations about how Air Force leaders have been influenced by other strategic cultural factors such as imperial, societal, or been affected by strong economic military nations throughout the 20th century. I codify RF culture as assumption of independence and control of the air spirit. Independent thinking has shaped our modern day thinking of Air Force generals, which inculcate self-reliance and adaptability stemming from its inception. Current RAF expeditionary air wings symbolize this self-reliance. The assumption of RAF independence owes itself to the Smuts report, where the RAF sought to link the ethos and technology as a more efficacious way of fighting war. But the effects of the report took time to come to fruition. Early 1931 was Lee Marillery able to bridge the cultural gaps between the Army and Navy by calling for air superiority in the battle space and legitimizing the use of air power. Control of the air spirit is more difficult to find, however. Doctrinally, it is offense-related that incorporated technological assumptions underpinning values and beliefs of the RAF. What makes it problematic is interpreting air power as part of the third dimension. It is characterized by the technological advantage over the adversary and based around the most efficient way of conducting war. This technology is organized into systems large and varied, requiring well-qualified individuals to service and fix the aircraft capable of working and thinking independently. Even Lilhart in his 1925 work, Paris and the Use of War, supported the efficient application of air doctrine to win war, recognizing the need for technologically minded people, an argument that is still going on with UAVs today. So, doctrine in the RAF was understood through education. The socialization through staff colleges allows the transfer of that critical cultural value and protects and promotes this as a capability. During 1913-31, Trenchard provided a practical framework to Air Force officers to emphasize the human element and develop the conceptual component. Teaming up with Henderson and Sykes, he pushed this cultural change because they were heavily involved in the detailed work of the Smuts report. They believed that the squadron organization should promote a regimental identity, but also adopt a corporate stance to ensure survival of the essential Air Force spirit. To do this, military education nurtured officers to defend independence. Trenchard enunciated the importance of training and linked it to the pillars of development of personnel that occurred during the intellectual changes of the Cardwell and naval military reforms in the late 19th century. Pivotal to our understanding of command leadership, therefore, is not just strategic theory, but strategic culture and its link to the development of this air generalship. Most academics such as Mao and Mahoney concede that the basic assumptions regarding theory and culture are made up of many intangibles that form part of the ethos within an organization. The ethos does not exist in strict isolation, but is in a mutual interactive relationship with each other. Key qualities I've identified were courage, vision, and decisiveness in codifying their generalship. Firstly, courage requires both physical and moral, which is shaped by good judgment and influenced by steely determination. Trenchard was imbued with this quality when he stoically defended the need for an independent air force during the interwar years. Fuller attributes Trenchard's vision of air-mindedness as essential to the joint working environment, or the ability to operate independently from the other services. Equally, more recently, General Moseley, USAF, also demonstrated the strength of character by making better use of air power during Operation Anaconda in the first phase of the Afghanistan campaign in 2002. A firm believer in the independent use of air power and joint operations, he achieves this by coordinating the disparate elements of air power effectively. Secondly, the do this or decisiveness factor alludes to the degree of faith that his subordinates have in the commander's knowledge. General Schwarzkopf allowed General Chuck Horner during Gulf War I a large amount of mission command to plan the air campaign with little meddling by politicians. conscious of the failings from Vietnam, he painfully remembered how American generals had failed to develop a strategy for Vietnam, which in turn led to bad command leadership because single service parochialism did not develop a unified and coherent recommendation to the president. It spawned a flawed pursuit of a conventional war to defeat the insurgency from the north. General Horner was determined not to make the same mistake. He did this successfully through media superiority and management, which added more pressures, proving another skill the general must master in shaping opinion of him and how operations are tackled. It has added complexity to decision-making and meant every action is open to scrutiny. Diplomacy as a facet of strategic leadership was added. General Eisenhower proved adept at this quality, managing senior officer relationships during campaigning in Northwest Europe in 1944-45. Similarly, General Horner had to develop effective political and military relationships to cohere the coalition relationship. This required him to be skillful and effective at relationship management, but also amenable to the public. He had CNN factor. Media-friendly, recognising the heroic narrative, such as those good luck stories, around the conflict to improve morale. This resonates with many pre-war theorists who supported the propaganda value of fighter pilot aces. Finally, the introduction of war has brought challenges requiring vision. This encompasses the need for experience, knowledge, and techniques to develop greater knowledge of knowing the enemy. Douay was expansive. It was sometimes ethereal in his thoughts and aphorisms, drawing on his personal experiences and knowledge from World War I to influence and shape European bombing theory during the 1930s. Despite both, their perspicacity, military leadership punished them for their visionary expression. This maverick style of constructive dissent is possibly missing in today's leaders in challenging orthodoxy. Douay and Mitchell possessed a similar passion of strategic bombing, which was shaped around early air doctrine. This focused on striking the war, making capabilities of industrialized nations in the air rather than a land domain which offered no guarantee of victory. Aircraft offered an alternative to the static nature of trench warfare by attacking the key vital centers of an enemy's war-making ability. It illuminated how early air power theorists, such as Douay and Mitchell, have influenced air power doctrine during the locust years of the 20s and recognized the airplane's potential to transform warfare. They have become central to conceptual thinking today. While some view Douay more of a prophet than a theorist, Mitchell developed a more precise and plausible theory of strategic bombing in his targeting policy. Similarly, General Michael Ryan expressed intellectualization of war. Following Operation Liberate Force in 1999, using lessons of intelligence, he nurtured the JFACs, I referred to earlier, by bringing in retired generals with experience commanding air operations to mentor future JFACs. Like Trenchard, his air-mindedness was expressed in the training environment. Among a number of other key conceptual developments was the introduction within the USAF of the Airborne Expeditionary Force, much like the RAF's EAW concept that made deployments more predictable and creating a sense of stability in these contingent environments. His creative intelligence meant he could gauge an understanding of the large aspects of war required for great generalship. But, however, the taxonomy of qualities perhaps overlooks the relationship to the nuclear revolution and the liberal democracy, which was ensnared into an existential struggle with the Soviet Union. In the Cold War, neorealist strategists such as Schnelling and Osgood had a huge impact on military thinking. So, that move towards the offensive and defensive nuclear way of thinking fostered distinct limited war thinking in the 50s and 60s. It deprived battlefield victory in the traditional sense and turned war into a mechanistic process predicated on Armageddon timetable of response that was deterministic in nature. Civil military complexities within a democratic environment, therefore, affect the practice of generalship in the field. As General de Gaulle observed, strategic success in war requires a consensus between politicians and the military. Cohen and Press argue the unequal dialogue means execution of generalship difficult in an environment when dealing with an enemy that adapts in a rapidly uncertain campaign. Tension between the Army staff and the White House emerged over strategy in Iraq in 2006 and 2007, and the political dismissal of General McChrystal by President Obama in 2011 demonstrate that despite a veneer of consensus, civil-military relationships always carry undercurrents of friction. So, based on these factors, has air generalship or command leadership withered on the vine? Evans would agree. He views the principle of successful generalship laid down by General Marshall in the Second World War as having declined. The hallmarks of the Marshall system included controlling senior officer appointments, high professional standards, accountability for command decision-making, and relief of non-performers by the Army staff. For the USAF, it was a similar complaint caused by a lack of intellectual military excellence to understand the theoretical basis and intricacies of the strategic level of war. There have been some exceptions, such as General Ryan and Mosley, but a few others have emerged to reverse the current trend of thinking, particularly in the US forces. So, to understand if it is declining the RAF, military analysts need to firstly translate the modern understanding of war into the old paradigm of doing business. The conceptualization of this is represented here in the Air Power Trinity. It highlights the contested conundrum of the third dimension and how air power is measured and exploited to the maximum potential amongst the triumvirate of factors, theory, practice, and technology, which is also underscored by doctrine, art, and science. Whilst technology may have been the driving force in the Cold War, its weakness was in providing deterrence capability at the expense of developing long-term strategic tenets and doctrine for a different type of military conflict. Today, commanders are alert to the effects of employing air power, but limited in the ability to collect, understand, and assess data to measure the psychological effects it seeks to achieve within this third dimension. Many of the Army commanding officers deployed to Afghanistan during Operation Herrick referred to it as on-the-job training, admitting to needing an appreciation of the enemy that is involved in both military and foreign policy planning. Lack of appreciation has therefore meant air generals, or command leadership, have struggled coming to terms in understanding how new adversaries, such as a Gaddafi, a Milosevic, or a Daesh leader, that comes to light. Beagle argues too much technology has severed the link between this tactical operational and strategic level, blurred by the airland Herrick experiences. The heavy reliance military commanders have placed on expensive intelligence assets to mitigate risk has allowed the notion of operating on the ground to become confused with the operational level. The conduct of tactical level RF operations has become an end in themselves, or to no higher intent, design, or banal purpose, memorably described by a task force Helmand brigade commander as mowing the lawn. To expand the zone of operational execution, generalship would have to develop operational art, arguably lost since the end of the Cold War. This should ideally consist of a command control system, i.e. a stronger operational level than the current operations suggest, which is enabled by CAS, the tactical effect, to better aid the mission, the strategic effect. Why is this? McNamara asserts that perhaps the RF has lost some of its integrated closeness to the Army during the 1990s in its drive to control air power centrally at the theatre level. This may have started in Gulf War I, where there was a decoupling of conceptual thinking away from the operational level from the influence of the USAF. Colonel Warden developed global rich global power theory, which represented a shift away from the operational employment of air power to a global strategic focus containing operational and strategic air campaign elements during Gulf War I. It was assessed that this global rich global power concept, driven by advances in technology, had eliminated air power's traditional limitations, allowing it to catch up to the promises of the air power pioneers. However, this expectation has not been realised, perhaps through lack of doctrinal developments. Consequently, Carter argued the kinetic use of air power within this power narrative came at the expense of using air power at the operational level within guided doctrinal principles. This may be down to a lack of understanding or execution of operational art, or through a lack of theoretical strategic creativity. A plausible theory of the split is that perhaps our air generals or command leaders have been locked into a heated and febrile inter-service rivalry that has been running since Options for Change in the 1990s and following strategic defence reviews in 2010 and 2015. Focus perhaps has not been on the strategic or tactical employment of available instruments, but more on the fundamental technological power and use of a weapon in the procurement of big-ticket capability platforms, such as the aircraft carriers or F-35 jets, and gaining an edge over the other signal services. Senior military leaders may have become subsumed in financial management to the detriment of their ability to imaginatively deploy air power. The prioritisation of niche capabilities is often cited as an, or even the answer to, cash-strapped defence departments. Stringer asserts, at the operational level, this does not bridge the conceptual shortfalls or ensure that technology will provide the decisive edge. So, this dichotomy of centralised control with flexibility must be addressed with critical thinking to explore the means of air power to its greatest exploitation. And we see this in the coercion theory. Coercion or compellence in the 1990s was geared around two phases of war fighting: the emergence of integrated operations with diplomacy, Operation Deliberate Force, and coercion, Operation Allied Freedom. It is like deterrence in that it focuses on influencing the adversary's decisions calculus. Essentially, this is concerned with affecting political and military outcomes through indirect military measures. Ceasefire, withdrawal of forces, or surrender by states that retain the capacity to carry on a battle. At the conventional level, air and naval forces would be used, while tactical air and ground forces would be shaping events on the battlefield. Coercion can be broken down to three key areas: the shelling model, looking at destroying the enemy but to shape their thinking into defeat; destroying economic infrastructure, the Douay model, which is the infliction of high costs to shatter civilian morale and cause citizens to pressure governments to stop land and oil; and the interdiction model. This focuses on military vulnerability by attacking rear air targets of importance and is more than likely to achieve coercive effect than the other two models. However, all must be not treated in isolation. Boyd and Pape both view these areas as a lost paradigm to air power, arguing that air generals need to exploit all three models to full effect. But opinion is divided. The consensus amongst coercion theorists is that coercion is no recipe for success and that it is harder than deterrence. Jacobson blames the theorists for lack of success, arguing coercive theory provides a poor understanding of prosecuting coercive war. However, this view does not consider the impacts of limited war thinking and the pervasive use of technology in recent conflicts. Moreover, while generals may have a grasp of coercive war strategies, they may not have the opportunity to demonstrate great generalship. So, scholars need to reassess how air power is employed and why technology has been leaned on in recent campaigns. This is reflected in the number of precision bombs dropped in Kosovo, 35%, compared with Gulf War I, 8%. Similarly, CAS support, close air support, was 75% in Operation Telic and during Operation Inherent Resolve, 79% of targets destroyed were dynamic, relying on fast air. Evidence shows a heavy emphasis on dynamic targeting rather than fixed targeting, and that the RF is being stovepiped into fully supporting narrow CAS functions of dynamic targets. However, while the ability to generate mass and flexibility is crucial, there is a view by Stringer that it has led to a flatlining of UK capability and a deviation from traditional air power doctrine. The air-land relationship is an indelible part to command relationships, but not necessarily driving the right environment for the development of generalship qualities. This is complicated by the need to ensure the conflict remains limited and accept that restrictions on the military will be politically essential and that technologically advanced forces will have to be deployed, increasingly relied upon, at quick readiness at the decisive place. So Air Vice Marshal Torpy commented that the RF has forgotten all that was good from the Cold War in terms of organisational confidence, while lessons have not been learned from the Balkans in the 1990s regarding interoperability and coercive strategies. It is from this baseline of perceived ill-preparedness today that comparisons can be drawn. So the first case study I'll throw up is the V-bomber force. The use of V-bombers has parallels with the Second World War bombing offensive, where the requirements for control of the air was universally recognised. During the late 50s and early 60s, the strategic element of the RF was assigned to NATO in the nuclear role as the V-bomber force. A key issue, however, was the command control of the nuclear weapons themselves, the veer between reliability and safety of the weapon and its system. The C2 of nuclear arsenals by the Strategic Air Command in the States returned to checklists and single service rivalry with fighter command. The SAC and USAF surfaced as the dominant services to control and introduce labyrinth safety procedures on nuclear weapons. Paradoxically, the thirst for safety and need for implementing checklists centralised the decision-making process that potentially stymied freedom of thinking for commanders thereby increasing accidents. At its inception, Air Chief Marshal Slessor oversaw the transition to the thermonuclear age based on his 1952 Global Strategy paper. Undeniably a great influencer on RAF doctrine through his phrase, the Great Deterrent, his unpopular decision did, however, create a revival of relations with the US that assisted in creating a joint nuclear policy following President Eisenhower and the New Look approach. This was a great success in reducing the scale and cost of war towards limited war thinking and getting away from the balanced forces and assured mass destruction so that they could afford to maintain without breaking themselves. According to Professor Howard, neither Brody or Littlehart or any other strategic thinker was in a position to translate their ideas directly into policy as Slessor did during the vital years 1950-52. The British Empire required the active application of air power all over the world, but here lay the problem. By the late 50s, the absence of a clear targeting policy and the stockpiling of weapons had created a C2 problem with Bomber Command. The Army, Navy and RAF had done little to coordinate their efforts, which meant duplication of plans, including with NATO. At stake was whether the command structure be centralised or decentralised, city busting or counterforce. There was little uptake by air generals in Bomber Command in dealing with this conundrum that applied very little thought to the way coercive strategy would be used. Saunby referred to the use of ballistic missiles as adding a new dimension to warfare. However, evidence from Pape would suggest otherwise. In meeting the Douay model of Pape's coercive strategy showed it was strategic in nature, but it did very little to assist the land forces. Like the prevalence of CAS culture today, use of the V-Force did not utilise the full range of our air power, should be employed by generals, and was narrowly focused on the capability, the power narrative, over influence methods. As an instrument of policy, self-deterrence, which Slessor expounded and advocated, may have avoided war, but the logic inconsistency of his live and let live approach was never resolved or answered if nuclear war was to break out. His use of the V-Force in preemptive strikes were keeping damage to acceptable proportions, at least so they thought, until the thermonuclear weapons were developed by the Soviets. So in comparison, Operation Deliberate Force provided strengthened diplomacy in exploiting air power. The operation was the epitome of minimum force that succeeded in winning hearts and minds with the minimum use of violence, as opposed to Slessor's great deterrent approach. It is assessing this relationship between targeting and desired political effect that lies at the heart of coercive strategy we see in the next case study. Coercion in the Balkans. Operation Deliberate Force was the NATO campaign against Bosnia Serbs in 1995, in which the RAF contributed 9.3% of the total sorties, a not inconsiderable amount. The warring factions were forced through the forceful use of air power to accept the UN brokered framework agreement. This was the first use of offensive air power in Europe since 1945, and the first instance in which Billy Mitchell's industrial web theory was applied in what Sullivan referred to as the critical component theory. A key lesson from this conflict is that it can defeat or lower an adversary's confidence by preventing it from achieving its military objectives and change the enemy decision-making. Such a denial strategy focus means it reduces the chances of an adversary's unwanted behaviour. Successful denial, Sullivan argued, required defeating the enemy's particular strategy, not just simply stopping its conventional military forces on the plains of Europe. The key lesson is to evaluate individual coercive instruments and their effectiveness in each crisis, including strategic goals set by the adversary, and whether these goals are vulnerable to military force. It is this area of air power which air generalship perhaps must apply its command and control. Despite its limited impact on Milosevic in 1999, air power was pivotal in the campaign and was able to leverage the local balance of forces in Bosnia and Kosovo in favour of NATO. Such a strategy, however, requires the existence of a viable indigenous or allied force that the coercing power can support. Strikes on C2 facilities also proved effective, despite assertions by military analysts that the operation was viewed as a cheap and easy military solution. Indeed, Grant described it as a drive-by shooting with cruise missiles. But this accusation perhaps undersells this success of the campaign. Use of air power coordinated to exploit third-party threats serves to impose immediate damage on an adversary and deny it from resisting it using threats. The most publicised advantage of air power is that it can improve domestic support by lowering the likelihood of casualties and concerns about civilian suffering through its ability to conduct precision operations. In sum, policymakers and generals must consider not only what they seek to accomplish through coercion, but also what they seek to prevent. As the Balkan contest proves, air power prosecuted effectively can preclude an adversary from doing what they want. To achieve this, air generals must recognise the need to balance ground and air forces together, including the different types of aircraft used. At the same time, it must also maintain its independent status that is coordinated with other services. A comparison to the other service elicits little else to prepare future air commanders. The RAF is now to size that its commitment to Operation Shade and may currently rule out a wider role, possibly later once it draws down, but at the moment still committed. For example, providing air superiority to ground forces concurrently in another campaign. While a popular view, relying on the allure of the niche, an expression that Stringer likes to use, brought on by the constraints above may be a misleading one, his view is that this rests largely on analysis of supporting Washington's intent. The Libyan campaign showed that the UK government was provided with policy and military options that included a range of air and maritime intelligence assets, strike and C2 capability, which afforded the UK a level of influence from the grand strategic to the tactical. Having gone from these opportunities, Stringer believes that configuring warfighting to value-added niche capabilities represents a gamble to how commanders can execute operations in the future. Would also limit UK influence with the US when it matters most at the grand strategic level. So how do air commanders conceptualise the problem of operational design? How do they get around it? Firstly, setting the conditions and operations, circumstances and influences must consider an air-minded culture so that air generals can agree on an air-centred language. In articulating the threat, airmen have tended to believe that a generic metaphor-based strategy will work repeatedly, and thus challenge Winston Churchill's observation that air power is the most difficult of all forms of military force to measure or even to express in precise terms. However, the average Air Force officer still lacks a pure vocabulary or lexicon in which to analyse air power theory, including confusing theory with doctrine. This may be down to the long-standing dependence of Air Force officers on Army terminology and advocates of land-based power. The term, for example, interdiction, illustrates the point. Interdiction is an action to destroy, disrupt, divert, or delay the enemy's surface potential against friendly forces or otherwise achieve its objectives. Unfortunately, this definition overlooks the potential of waging an interdiction campaign with air power and wrongly presupposes the goal of war is to destroy the enemy army, and that air operations are mere prologues to this necessary act. Secondly, geography is critical, in particular, location of C2. The United States Africa Command, based at Stuttgart, Germany, is far from the regional stability operations it conducts in Africa. This location does allow the Combined Air Operations Center, or the CAOC, to shift from one area to another swiftly for Air Force purposes, Operation Herrick to Shader, but this may not suit the land campaign effort or key leadership arrangement. This dislocation sometimes is referred to as logic of circumstance, meaning senior leadership are isolated from reality, like the Chateau Generals of the First World War, characterised by detachment, moderation and power of analysis. Lord Mountbatten understood this clearly by moving the Command-in-Chief Post headquarters from the Middle East to the Far East in 1944, thereby creating an effective and efficient command structure between General Slim and Air Marshal Park to deliver air supply operations to the 14th Army, and did this in a very successful way. This meant that he had leadership presence and influence where it mattered. Similarly, not having influence in key appointments in the CAOC in Al Udeid has relegated the role of the RAF's EAG concept just to force generation and deployment. It is responsible for most UK operations in the Operations Kipian and Shader joint operations area. Whilst it is situated appropriately at Al Udeid, it is only blistered onto the CAOC, where the AOC serves as a contingent commander towards a combined joint force air component commander, and largely remains situated, sometimes unfairly criticised, in a voyeuristic leadership role, providing packets of air power on request by the JFAC. Instead, the AOCs and the RAF should be in a position to develop theatre campaign plans and be inserted into key appointments to influence those appointments. Use of the phrase independent has also turned into a pejorative expression. In terms of providing a forward presence and emphasising the projection of power, the RAF has not developed its strategic bombing concepts beyond supporting the land campaign. Like the French Air Forces of the early 20s, Vanassen argues that the issue is down to the hegemony of the army, large budgets and influence, and the centralisation of decision-making in the predominant role of security policy. Extrapolate this thinking to today, the centralised institutional filter from airland dominance of single-service rivalry has arguably shaped air generalship goals towards tactical operations seen in current ops. Finally, Carter and Sullivan cite history as important for air commanders to study and deal with current issues of possible doctrinal decline. In the 30s, the drift towards an offensive ideology neglects the experimental testing and detailed planning within a coercive strategy. Its failure to develop operational plans led to a mismatch in projected employment concepts and actual capabilities of its independent bomber fleet, which came to light in its fight against Germany in the Second World War. Schlesser's flawed pursuit of the offensive in the 1950s, latterly in the 50s, also led to unexpected operational and potentially strategic consequences following the introduction of the Soviets' thermonuclear bombs and their surface-to-air missiles. That being said, what would develop the strategic bombing concepts necessary to bridge this conceptual gap in making a workable framework for air generals? The Thinking to Win strategy, introduced by E.V.M. Stringer in 2014, sets out to bridge this gap. The idea has all the right intent and does require some momentum at the station level so that it is not viewed as rhetoric and that it has some momentum. Rather than a refresh, this is a cultural change and has widened the scope to the broader aspects of leadership at all levels. To develop its strategic thinking to airmen, it is not a roadmap to success, but an attempt to enthuse and encourage debate to that conceptual component as an intellectual activity. The philosophy recognised other limitations, such as the tendency for airmen to be risk-averse, stifling creativity and not taking bold decisions, stymieing maverick tendencies we see in traditional generals, discouraging boldness and innovation that would be career-limiting. The challenge is to how we allow all this to happen. This does, of course, mean that the intellectual component is not any less in the Army and Navy, far from it, rather just some subtle changes to make the system a little bit better. There is a much healthier respect for achievements of the RAF due to the commitments to jointry and support to the land campaign during Operation Telic and Herrick, but more could be done. Command can be distinguished as an intellectual activity. The RAF's problem appears to be a need to understand the status of its conceptual components, to find where it needs to be in the future, and then plot a course to get there, and not be seen as another continuous improvement initiative. So my view is that critical thinking is important. How do we learn? Bungay and Evans take a historical view of how lessons can be learned from the past in developing the talent for senior command. Von Moltke did this very well when he recognised that military education would steer the concept of the bounded initiative in the right direction to develop both individuals and the organisation for future appointments. Failure to innovate boils down to poor knowledge in the art of war, and this is because it is entrenched in a tactics-based approach. Unfortunately, the method for providing the all-round education required to instill support and sustain the desired leader behaviours has yet to be determined. The following command and control methods could be employed in commanding personnel and managing politicians. Firstly, every good relationship the government must have is trust in its generals. I'll reflect this in the diagram you see on the board. This trust is irrespective of its control to enable them to command. Many senior officers view mission command as key to empowering airmen on operations. If there is trust in the general, then there is more confidence they have with his abilities. In addressing trust, Bungay proposes two dimensions. The first is moral, having confidence in supporting an effective briefing process. The second is practical, by trusting an individual through mission command to deal with unknown unknowns, by identifying linkages and commonalities with a previous experience and knowledge of historical precedents. It is then up to the commander to create a context in which trust can be fostered that relies on this consultation. In 2002, Brigadier Roger Lane, leader of 3 Commander Brigade, deployed on 3 Commander Brigade following in early 2002, was removed from command following a lack of boss-centered leadership he displayed during Operation Takana. Lack of trust between himself and the US Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, led to media disagreements, a contradiction of when the war in Afghanistan would end. Mr. Rumsfeld then publicly disagreed with him. Scrutiny of commanders has become an indelible part of political life. Trust is key to providing this framework. Bungay's unified approach helps institutionalize this process across the three services. It enables the organization to become much more agile to emerging challenges and potentially reduces the power asymmetry between single services rivalry. By focusing on this area of trust, will improve their ability to conduct unplanned battles more astutely and to grasp their interpretation of reality on more informed decision-making. Sol refers to this framework as agile absorption, balancing absorption and agility in dealing with world turbulence. He argued that the success of command leadership relies on continuous interactions as a recipe for success. We represent this in the OODA loop, observe, orientate, decide, act. It perhaps does not consider the many tangibles and factors that affect waging coercive war. Graphically illustrated with events that unfolded in the Cuban Missile Crisis. I've got the slide up here. There we go. Many of Kennedy's advisors believe the Soviets understood only power and respect only force. Because Kennedy knew Khrushchev personally, Kennedy was aware that Khrushchev despised war. So it is about understanding our adversary that plays a key part in analysis. Therefore, Kennedy considered Khrushchev's personal intentions more important than the organization. However, Kennedy lacked trust in his team's decision-making and avoided anchoring on a single interpretation of a situation against the Soviet existential threat and the obvious conclusion that missiles signaled an escalation of hostilities. By discussing alternative actions and interpretations, Kennedy made it safe to discuss the soft options of blockade and diplomatic negotiation and avoided this escalation. Air generals need to make use of these concepts. One option is red teaming, used to simulate different points of view for leaders to resolve problems. The USMC, United States Marine Corps, regularly challenges the command and climate through red teaming at the subunit level when General Ramos introduced it in 2012. The second area is decision making. Experiences in Kosovo showed that the subtleties of the battle space were understood and considered without resorting to predictable responses. Circumstances can oscillate between chaotic and non-chaotic states, quickly affecting how leadership is practiced with the subordinates. Because of this, complex issues are often ignored in favor of providing the obvious solution, like President Roosevelt was expected to do against the Soviets when the missiles were being deployed on Cuba. The leader should first consider complexity in his thinking rather than a straightforward approach and allow for diversity. For repeatable situations, previous experience offers no reliable anticipation of uncontrollable or unforeseen events. Overwhelmed by complexity in the current contingency paradigm, autocratic leadership is perhaps not compatible to complex adaptive systems. Appropriate analysis is needed to reduce uncertainty and improve our intuition to a problem. Air generals may need to advocate a more intellectual, intuitive response to advance our knowledge of knowing the problem. Raising this level of knowledge may allow a better understanding of different single service cultures in competitive joint environments. Air generalship courses should be developed pan-service wide and formalise selection process of pilots who move into 3-star or higher joint appointments. General Breedlove is an example, who was the outgoing commander shape, is a good example of a well-balanced career structure touching on all the main assignments. His experience ranged from appointments in strategic defence policy and government to joint defence appointments in the UN. Okay, in conclusion, kinetic targeting delivered by Operation Shader does not demonstrate an operational level of success evident in the Second World War, during the Cold War, or the coercive strategies employed in Kosovo. Success of close air support has certainly improved response times and enabled the armed forces to operate on the ground in difficult and challenging environments. Unfortunately, the mindset has remained geared towards a supporting role of joint missions. So, in answer to my question, has air generalship declined? To an extent, then there has been a theoretical decay driven from a post of Herakleitic mindset. Air power has been shoehorned into niche capabilities supporting the land campaign and driven by the costly needs of defence. Admittedly, the macro environment is different now than what it was in the Second World War and 30s. But the principles of independent air power remain the same, control of the air and air spirit. That is not to say that generalship does not have a place in these niche capabilities, but perhaps is selling itself short, being stovepiped into the tactical domain of other niche areas such as cyberspace. The RF should incorporate air-centric strategies and challenge the assumptions that it will become a land-supported campaign. Most operational campaigns since the Second World War, the RF has supported the land component of the United States, Iraq and Afghanistan, and become channeled into operating a CAS and interdiction capability. This has created a false sense of achievement at the tactical level, theatre, and absent at the operational level, where the kernel of intellectual development should sit in the imaginative use of air power. Tackling the third dimension and leading the Air Force at the theatre level in its campaign planning is imperative. The period post-Operation Herrick can be described as a watershed of generalship following the clattering of bits that define the execution of OPELMI. Key to bridge this gap is practice through training selection and career management. To grow future air generals in the RF needs to increase training on EAW Air Combat Service Support Units with logistics and communications, so it's not just about flying planes, it's connecting the two, so it brings coherence to the exercises and operations, including practicing the JFAC role on a more frequent basis in its key C2 roles as part of that collective training. Incorporating this learning into the Senior Officer Study Program and red teaming may bring dividends, delivering improved scenario-based training, which give real situations and measuring staff's ability to predict the outcomes. Recent examples could be used as the exemplar, such as General McChrystal. In 2009, he redefined counterinsurgency in Afghanistan to a hearts and minds approach campaign of perception against the Taliban. Notwithstanding the difficulties of stabilization timetables, may also inform strategic air power thinking in this conceptual area that incorporates the soft area of COIN as a critical enabler for a permissive operating environment. Intellectual debate must discuss how Air Force credibility can sustain domestic support or coalition unity without eliminating political constraints. Airstrikes can be seen as a low-risk, low-cost measure by politicians. Successful coercion is far harder when casualties start mounting or when airstrikes fail to break the will of the adversary. Changes to address the conceptual gap will require more than just trenchant views on single service identity. All services need to join the debate that does not favour its own single service. Senior air commanders need to understand air power in its totality as an enabler and not lose the fight at the operational level. Thank you.